squawky, and all human, for which I am grateful. Not all the archive staff are warm-blooded. Hi, this is Bob Howard in Ops. Back on Thursday, I requested an archival document retrieval, 10 dead files. I'm going through them now, and one of them is missing. I've got a file number and an annotation saying document not found on designated shelf. Can you tell me what that means?
It means, she sounds irritated, the librarian couldn't find your file. They looked where it was supposed to be and it wasn't there.
Oh, is there a direct mapping between the document reference number and a given shelf?
Yes, there is. You should really use code names and the index in case a file's been assigned a new number, you know. It happens sometimes. Do you have a code word for me? I could look it up for you.
I'm sorry, my colleague just gave me a list of document reference numbers, I explain. And he's, off sick, so I'm trying to figure out what's missing. I was worried that the file had been sent over and got misplaced, but if it's missing in the stacks, I suppose that just means it's been renumbered. Or he wrote down the wrong reference, or something. I don't believe the last one for a split second. No way would Angleton get a file number wrong. But I don't want some nosy librarian poking her nose into my investigation. Bye. I put the phone down and lean back, thinking. Let's see. Angleton was working on Bloody Baron. When I came back to the office, he gave me a list of 10 files to read. Then he went missing. This coincides with an upswing in Russian activity, including a marked willingness to use extreme measures. 9 files came from the stacks, and they turn out to be tedious backgrounders relating indirectly to the historical investigation side of Bloody Baron. The 10th file isn't on its shelf. All I've got is a number, not a name. I think it's time to do some unofficial digging. Meanwhile, back to the historical reconstruction. It is nearly 6 o'clock when Mr. Dower finishes typing his report. He's lost track of the time, his head locked inside the scope of his post-mortem on the instrument. He's read about it like before. Their design is attributed to a deaf-mute German violinist in Paris in the early 1920s, but nobody actually built one until the ghastly Dr. Mabuse commissioned an entire string section from a certain Berlin instrument maker in 1931. It should be no surprise that the instrument maker prospered under the subsequent regime, but was executed after a summary trial by Smirsch investigators in 1946. This particular instrument made its way to the West in the luggage of a returning GI, was retrofitted with electric pickups during the 1950s, and after a spectacular run of accidents, was acquired by a reclusive collector in 1962, believed by some to be a front for a British government department, who, as a matter of state policy, did not like to see such instruments in the wrong hands. He dreads to think what its reappearance portends. On the other hand, the young woman who brought it to him, Mr. Dower thinks of everyone aged under 50 as young, seemed to have a sober appreciation of its lethality. He shudders fastidiously as the last of 5 pages of single-space description hisses out of the inkjet printer. It joins the half-dozen contact pages of photographs, including his fiber-optic examination of the interior of the instrument and an invoice for just over £2,000. He shakes the bundle of pages together and binds them neatly with a paperclip from a desk drawer. Then they go inside the envelope the woman who called herself Cassie May gave him. He licks the flap and seals it. Then, in a moment of curiosity, he switches on the anti-counterfeit lamp he keeps by the cash register and examines it under ultraviolet light. Nothing shows up. It bears none of the UV fluorescent dots the post office prints on envelopes to control their routing. If Cassie May thinks she can retrieve an unmarked envelope from the postal system, she's welcome to it in Mr. Dower's books. He turns back to the computer and deletes his work, then sighs and glances at the clock. 5 minutes to closing time. No point keeping the shop open any longer. He stands and stretches, switches the computer off, and goes through an abbreviated version of his regular closing routine. No point banking the cash register contents. His takings before the woman's visit barely amounted to petty cash. He pulls on his coat, turns his coffee mug upside down on the draining board, switches off the lights, and opens the front door. The woman is waiting for him. She smiles. "Have you finished your report?" she asks. Mr. Dower nods, confused.
"I was going to post it, as you requested."
He pats his coat pocket.
"I'm in a hurry. There's a rush on. If you don't mind."
She looks at him impatiently.
Of course.
He pulls out the envelope and hands it to her.
My invoice is enclosed.
You don't need to worry about that side of things.
She slides the envelope into her black patent leather handbag and smiles.
I suppose not. You people always pay your debts eventually.
Yes, you can be absolutely certain of that.
He turns back to the door and fumbles with his keyring, which is why he doesn't see her withdraw a silenced pistol from her bag, raise it to the back of his head, and discharge a single round into his cerebellum. The gun makes little sound, just the racking click of its action. But as she fires, the suppressor fitted to its muzzle frosts over with clear fluid, air in contact with its liquefying as it chills to just above absolute zero. Mr. Dower slumps forward against the door. The woman's arm follows him down with absolute precision and discharges a second round into the top of his skull, but it is unnecessary. He is already dead. She looks around with green eyes as deep as sacrificial cenotes, eyes in which a sensitive witness might see luminous worms writhing. But there are no sensitive witnesses to see through the glamour. Just the ordinary post-work crowd hurrying about their business on the London streets. For a moment, her face shimmers, the facade sliding. Her attention is strained, flying in too many directions to maintain the illusion effectively. But then she notices and pulls herself together. She returns the chilly pistol to her bag. Then, turning on one spiked heel, she strides away from the corpse. Just another professional woman on her way home from the office. Nobody has witnessed the killing, and it will be 20 minutes before a passing policeman realizes that the drunk sleeping in the doorway is never going to rise again.